I'm Brian Kloss, and you're listening to Power Corrupts, the podcast where we shine a light onto the hidden and often nefarious forces that shape our world. Welcome back to Season 3. We're going to kick things off this season with a two-part episode in which we'll travel to some island paradises, places lined with palm trees and ringed by turquoise seas, to uncover the world of illicit offshore finance. And we're going to explore the dirty, often bizarre secrets about how rich and powerful people squirrel away their money, far away from the tax man and the prying eyes of journalists. Our first destination, what we're focusing on in part one of this two-part episode, is a microstate in the furthest reaches of the Pacific Ocean, the world's third smallest country, a country that has a square footage that is only larger than the city-states of Vatican City and Monaco. Manhattan is three times bigger. It's a country with a fate that follows many of the most consequential developments in global politics over the last century. A little barometer for everything that's broken with geopolitics, power imbalances, and bad people taking advantage of the weak links in the global system. It's a tale of greed, corruption, environmental destruction, and how and why the Davids of the globe can become Goliaths of illicit finance.
I think the country was worth at one point close to $1 billion.
And what do you do if you have money but no island? Easy, you buy another island.
Unexpectedly, the president accepts and will financially back this musical.
Probably their failing was they were very naive and they had no idea they were being laughed at.
We all know that offshore areas of financial secrecy exist. Today, we're going to take a look at the origin story of one of them. It's a story that will make you question the caricature that you probably have in your head about why shadowy offshore economies develop. And it's a story that involves, quite improbably, seabirds that made people rich, a failed musical about Leonardo da Vinci, and a shack worth $1 billion. Many of you will never have heard of this country. But you can rest assured that Russian mobsters, terrorists on the run, and kingpins of the criminal underworld know all about it. I'm talking about the island of Nauru,
a United Nations trust territory. Administration is exercised by Australia on behalf of the administering authority, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. It is the home of about 2,500 Nauruans.
I am Hammer the Robert, head chief of the Nauruan people. Our island is far out in the Pacific. We are basically a Polynesian people, but our beginnings and much of our history are lost in the past.
Okay, I'm recording. I'm Jack Hitt. I'm a writer for the New York Times Magazine and sometimes for This American Life, a public radio program here in the United States. If you look at a map of the Pacific, there's hundreds of islands scattered throughout. But if you look at the very center of the belly of the Pacific, it's kind of mostly empty. But right there in the center, like a little belly button, a little omphalos of the globe, is Nauru. And it is the one piece of land that you can be on that's the farthest away from any other piece of land on the planet. I think it's 1,200 miles to the nearest spit of land from Nauru. All ocean in every direction. So it's the most isolated, or certainly among the most isolated places on the earth.
In 1798, a British trading captain named John Fearn became the first Westerner to spot Nauru, this little blip of land. He named it Pleasant Island because it was such an idyllic little place. But the name Nauru later replaced it, a word that means fittingly, I go to the beach. It was paradise on earth.
The island itself is like a perfect Pacific atoll. If you Google it right now, you'll see that it's pretty much a circle. Coral atolls are formed by an eruption from an underwater volcano. That lava eventually hardens and comes close to the surface or to the surface, and then essentially bird droppings and other things sort of gather onto the atoll and fill it in, and it becomes an island.
And over a huge stretch of time, the birds that helped form the island kept coming. As Selena Shannon, a senior producer for Audiocraft and a journalist who reported on Nauru for ABC Australia, explains, those birds used the island as a layover, though they'd always leave some of their unnecessary baggage behind.
So basically, this tiny Pacific nation in the middle of the ocean was a great stopover for seagulls that were flying over, and they would land on Nauru and basically leave their waste all over it.
And then after many millennia, topsoil formed, trees arrived through bird droppings, of course, and then you had a kind of island paradise, the kind we all picture in our heads when we think of an island in the Pacific, when you say the word Tahiti or Samoa.
To the eyes of Europeans sailing around the Pacific, this beautiful tiny island seemed like a decent prize to add to an empire. So Nauru, which had mostly kept to itself for quite a long time, entered the world of geopolitics.
So Nauru was colonized, I think, about 100 years ago. And in the first few decades after being colonized, it was passed around different countries.
It was originally a German colony.
And while the Germans were there, a little fluke of history played out, a bit unexpectedly, when one of the German colonizers happened to take a closer look at the rock that he'd been using to keep his office door propped open.
Some engineer was there and he said, man, what is this rock? It looked like they thought it was petrified wood or something. And it turns out it was just the densest phosphate, i.e. compacted, composted bird droppings that this engineer had ever seen. And so that awakened in everyone's imagination the idea that Nauru might be this gold mine of what was then a much sought after element or chemical or ingredient in farming.
Seabirds had given Nauru unexpected riches, some of the best phosphates in the world.
The change began when European explorers moved into the Pacific and was accelerated when phosphate was discovered here at the turn of the century. Phosphate is the only economic resource of the island, and from it stem the improved living standards, health, education, and other services enjoyed by the Nauruan community today.
And it's actually a really valuable fertilizer, particularly in Australia, because Australian soil is really lacking in phosphate, so there's a huge need for it over here.
By the 1960s, Nauru began to forge its own destiny, paid for by the seagull gold that formed the interior of the island.
So they became independent in the late 60s, and so they very suddenly came into this huge amount of money from their phosphate trade. It was millions and millions of dollars per person on this really tiny island that didn't really have much else going on.
I think the country was worth at one point close to $1 billion.
For the next few decades, just was spending really big, buying cars, even though the island only had one road, building golf courses, all this kind of stuff.
Nauru would have been the richest country on the planet per capita, since everyone on the island shared in the wealth. And so what you had was these cinder block houses went up, cars were purchased, you know, all the food was flown in from Australia, and a life of luxury, really, for one of these islands.
The problem, of course, was that the riches were being produced by a decidedly finite resource. Birds kept stopping over on Nauru, but as huge quantities of phosphates were being shipped off the island, it would have taken millennia for the phosphates to be replenished. The boom times quickly turned to bust. This is from a CBS News report from the island in the 1980s.
What happens when the phosphate runs out?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Nauruans don't seem terribly worried about it. Islanders don't see much point in worrying. And besides, there's the Phosphate Trust Fund. The island will be worth at least $1 billion when the island is gone. Nauru may have sold its soil to the devil, but it's gotten a good price. And what do you do if you have money but no island? Easy. You buy another island.
We need our own island. If we can buy other islands to have as our own, fine, but they are not too easy to find.
And slowly the phosphate reserves started running out, and then the money that they had made and had put aside was running out even faster. And so it only took a couple of decades between them gaining independence and becoming in control of this money and this phosphate economy. It was only a couple of decades before it not only all ran out, but they massively went into debt as a country.
The island's phosphate trust fund wasn't enough. And so, without taking drastic action, the island risked going bankrupt. But what do you do when you're an island with precisely one resource, and you've used it all up?
And so they do a few different things. They kind of start dabbling. They start experimenting with different ways and places to invest their money. So they invest in an Australian football club that was a terrible investment. The football club was really in decline already, and they were unable to save it, so they lost, you know, $1 million in that. They started buying hotels all over the world. They started doing things like they put their UN vote up for sale, and they launched an airline, even though they're a tiny country, and the airline serviced dozens of countries, even though the planes going there had hardly any people in them. So they kept making these kind of weird financial investments that weren't really paying off.
Finally, in the early 1990s, Nauru starts toying with the idea of getting into dark money, becoming a one-stop shop for anyone who wants to hide some ill-gotten gains in a place that is effectively an invisible blip in the middle of the ocean. This is where the Russian mafia starts to get involved, as the island becomes a tiny offshore empire.
Somewhere in there, they decided to start to take advantage of the emerging global economy and figure out ways to provide income. And one of the first ways was to create this bank scam.
This bank scam was a new innovation. Previously, having offshore accounts meant that you could hide your money in a bank that didn't ask too many questions. But there's still a risk to that, because as we'll see in the next episode, those bank records could get leaked, or a bank employee with a big mouth could rat you out to the authorities. Nauru decided to cut out that middleman. For just $25,000, you would have the honor not of opening an offshore account, but actually opening and owning your own offshore bank. No questions asked.
Other countries were doing it too, but Nauru was the most thorough at creating an entire banking system that essentially became a black hole in any sort of financial forensic quest. So in most banks, under most national laws, you have to keep a record of who owns this bank, who has accounts in it, the money that goes into these accounts, where that comes from, and where it goes going out, right? Except Nauru. They allowed you to form a bank where you didn't have to say who you were. You could do it online. You could have money coming in from somewhere, and you didn't have to record it, and you could have it going out somewhere, and you didn't have to record that either. So it became the perfect sort of money laundering system. It's much simpler than buying cheap real estate in Florida, the usual sort of scammy things that oligarchs do to wash their funds out of dictatorial countries and into Western economies.
Now, you might not have $25,000 kicking around, and you may not have any reason to open your own secret bank. Its defining feature is its ability to keep your money hidden in the shadows cast by palm trees on an island that nobody's ever heard of. But because this was the early 1990s, Nauru's timing was perfect when it came to finding its shady first clients.
I first heard about Nauru when my editor at the New York Times Magazine, Dan Zaloski, called me up and said that he had read that there was an enormous amount of money coming out of the collapsing USSR, right? Now Russia. But at the time, I think we were still in the sort of detritus of 1989. Communism had fallen. And what was happening was one of the largest scale lootings of a national economy ever. All the oligarchs basically collected all of their funds and got them out of Russia, out of the USSR, and were putting them in various offshore banks.
Once again, the island's fate was partly decided by geopolitical events thousands of miles away. But as illicit money started to slowly wash onto Nauru's shores, the government realized that it needed a plan B, in case the whole world of dirty cash didn't work out. They decided to use some of that Russian money to create a more lasting investment. This is where Nauru's story follows an improbable twist, written by a man named Duke Minks, who we'll come to after this short break. I hate ads during podcasts. I bet you do too. That's why I've decided not to have any this season. And it's possible to do that because I make Power Corrupts independently, and I do it for fun rather than to make money. But it does cost money to produce each episode. So if you want to support my work, there are two ways that you can help out. The first is a bit unconventional, but here goes. Pre-order my new book, Corruptible: Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, which comes out on November 9th. From CEOs and criminals to cult leaders and homeowners association tyrants, I explore the bizarre relationship between humans and power. And it's the most fun thing that I've ever written, so I hope you'll enjoy it. Second, you can become a subscriber on Patreon, where you'll get access to bonus content including uncut interviews, the chance to win having beers or coffee with me over Zoom, depending on your preferences and time zone, of course, and even a full bonus episode this season on the history of corruption. Go to patreon.com/powercorrupts for more details, and thank you for listening and for your support. Now, back to Duke Minx and to Nehru.
So Duke Minx, back in the 60s, was a roadie for a band. I think the band was called Unit 2 plus 4 or Unit 4 plus 2.
I checked, by the way. It's Unit 4 plus 2. They had a one-hit wonder in the 1960s.
He spends a few years as a roadie in the 60s in the music scene, and then he eventually moves into the finance sector, I guess. And at some point in his career, he eventually becomes one of Nehru's financial advisors. And so he's in conversation with Nehru, advising them on different investments they can make. And he's still in touch with the lead singer of this band that he was a roadie for back in the 60s. And one day they're chatting, and the singer of the band, a guy called Tommy Moeller, he puts this idea to Duke Minx, and he says, oh, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful to write the next big musical and maybe Nehru could invest in it? So it's actually this guy's idea, and he puts it to Duke, and then Duke takes it to the president of Nehru, and somewhat unexpectedly, the president accepts and agrees that Nehru will financially back this musical that this musician from the UK is writing.
For the low, low price of just $7 million, Duke Minx promised the power brokers in Nehru that he would deliver a West End and Broadway bonanza. Because, as everyone knows, musicals are the surest way to make big money.
I lived in New York most of my life, and that was kind of a running joke, was that anyone who would invest in a theater production, a theater angel, was someone who had to do it for love and for no other reason. Because almost certainly you were going to lose your shirt.
Of course, if you've got an amazing idea for a musical, you might just get lucky. And Nehru decided to hang its financial fate partly on, well, I wouldn't say it's an amazing idea, but certainly it was a unique one. The show was to be about Leonardo da Vinci falling in love with the Mona Lisa. There were only two problems with that idea. But to be fair, they were reasonably big ones.
We can perhaps discuss what was the flaw of having a musical based on Leonardo da Vinci's love life.
It's a pretty sloppy concept because my understanding is that it's pretty widely accepted that Leonardo da Vinci was probably gay, and there's no historical evidence to support that he ever had any relationship that was romantic with the Mona Lisa. But the musical is about their love, and it's full of love songs between them and serenading and him agonizing over not being able to paint her.
Maybe someone should have rethought that.
A tax haven musical partly funded by seagulls and partly funded by Russian oligarchs and mobsters. I was hooked. So I tracked down an old playbill for Leonardo the Musical, A Portrait of Love. I started Googling the names of actors and actresses who had appeared in major roles, hoping to track one of them down to ask them about the production. Finally, I got a hit. I believed I'd found Lisa Hollander, an actress who had top billing in the show for playing one of the main roles. I found what I thought was her phone number and texted her out of the blue, in what must have been the most insane message she'd received in some time, asking her whether I could speak to her about musicals, mafia money, seabirds, corruption, and an island called Nehru. She responded almost immediately with one line, "Sorry, you've got the wrong Lisa."
So I just made an assumption and I went, no, you've obviously got the wrong person, because I didn't read it properly. What I read was Leonardo da Vinci Museum. I didn't read musical. So hence my sort of, oh no, well, that's not definitely not me.
Thankfully, I persisted, insisting that I was pretty sure she was the right Lisa. When she reread my message, she was a bit taken aback, as she hadn't thought about Leonardo da Vinci the musical for a few decades, and she knew next to nothing about where it came from, who paid for it, or why it would be of interest to someone for a podcast more than a quarter century later. And so I told her the whole story, much to her bewilderment and amusement. And then I asked her, how had she ended up in this seemingly doomed-to-fail production?
Yes, it's quite funny, actually. I was in a production at the Newbury Watermill Theatre, which, if I had a little look over here, I could even find out what it was called. On Approval. On Approval at the Watermill Theatre in Newbury. The days before mobile phones, which my children think is hysterical, we would get the payphone there, would ring. And I remember I was standing there and I got a call from my agent saying, OK, Lisa, we've got an audition for you, say tomorrow or next day, for the musical Leonardo. And immediately I said, well, that's the one that's going to close, isn't it? Which is an extraordinary reaction. And my agent said, oh, yeah, but work's work. So sure enough, I auditioned for it and I got the part of Catherine, which now I look back is hardly even mentioned. You know, the character doesn't exist as far as I can Google, but it was in the days before the internet. So, but I was definitely in it.
The reason Lisa had that extraordinary reaction, knowing it was likely to close before it even opened, is because the reviews for the musical's preliminary run in Oxford were in, and they were awful. One critic even called it, quote, utter bilge. Lisa wasn't naive, so she knew that reviews like that meant that this musical wasn't going to be the next Cats, and that its days were numbered.
Certainly in those days, the press had a huge influence on what was going to succeed and what was going to fail before it had even been written, virtually. And that's very much what happened. Very much what happened with this story.
Lisa's mom, who attended the show, remembers things a bit differently than the reviewers did.
I was asking my mom, I said, you know, what are your memories of the show? And she said, it wasn't as bad as they said. And she got very upset because she was standing outside on the first night listening to these, dare I say, slightly pompous reviewers going blah-de-blah about this dreadful production and blah. And she was sitting there saying, you know, have they been watching the same show? It isn't bad. Yes, there are bits of it that are a bit, oh, willow. But as a story, and it, I think I saw somewhere it said it was the biggest flop in London or something. And I thought, no, I don't think so. I'm sure if you do a bit of research, you'll find a lot of other shows that have lost an awful lot more money.
Every day and every night, every joke, however tried, out of mind and out of sight, hoping she will disappear, only makes me want her near. But when I meet her most, she's never there to set me free. But she lives with me.
Fair or not, the show did flop, which was an unpleasant surprise for the government of Nehru, which was clearly anticipating a different reaction.
For the opening of the musical, about 100 dignitaries from Nehru flew on their airline, Air Nehru, to London for the opening night. And so they were all in the audience, and they all loved it, apparently.
My mum does remember a lot of dignitaries being there. She just remembers them having a lovely time, she said. Oh, they had a lovely time. They were enjoying the show and they hoped it was going to be a big hit. And Mum said, I think probably their failing was they were very naive and they had no idea they were being laughed at.
25 years later, Lisa went back again to listen to some of the tunes. And again, she was pleasantly surprised.
It was a good musical, I think. And I think the music that we've heard, that we've found online, I think they're very good. I don't know if I'm not hearing what other people hear, but I think they're very good tunes, you know, they're very good songs. It was a giggle, to be honest.
After the musical flopped and Nehru's government lost $7 million, there was even more pressure to make the illicit finance machine hum to life. And by the late 1990s, it had. Some estimates even suggest that up to $70 billion was flowing through banks registered in Nauru at the time. Banks that were all operating out of a single billion-dollar shack filled with computer equipment that hosted the servers. So in 1999, Jack Hitt decided to try and visit the shack.
Well, when I first tried to go there, they told me that they didn't allow journalists, and so I just took a rather semantic perspective and went there as a tourist. I never had to misrepresent myself because when I got to the customs in Brisbane, Australia, so that was the only city that had a flight on Air Nauru at the time to the island. So you had to fly to Australia first, Sydney, and then up to Brisbane, and then fly over to Nauru. And when I was checking in there, I'd booked the flight, that was not a problem. But when I was checking in with their customs, they asked me what was my preferred description of my profession. And I said I was an essayist, which is true. It also turns out that there was about a dozen Australian scientists who were all essayists, A-S-S-A-Y, on the plane with me.
An assayist, by the way, is a person who analyzes rocks and metals to determine the quantity and quality of the ores hiding within.
And so we were all just ushered onto the plane. And I spelled it correctly on my documentation and walked onto the plane and landed in Nauru. After that, I was sort of like on the run the entire time I was there.
Almost immediately, Jack got a sense of how parochial the island was and how badly the Nauruans had ruined their tropical paradise.
It's just a bit of a hike from the airport to the one motel that they had. When I got there, and it looked like any other hotel, except that there was no really any running water. And for the entire, I think I was there for about 5 days, I never had any water except one time when I tried to shower and it came up for about a minute. There's no natural water left on the island, so all water has to be either desalinated or flown in these large plastic crates that are fitted, customized to fit into the chairs of a Boeing 737, which is what I think. The Air Nauru had one plane, and the back half of it was filled with these customized crates, which were filled with mostly water.
Settled in, but without having a shower, Jack set off to find the euphemistically named Nauru Agency Corporation, the entity that was responsible for hosting all the shell banks, those hubs of illicit finance. Anyone who wanted to open one of those banks just needed to visit www.antitaxes.com and fork over $25,000, and voila, you've got yourself a bank. The website's pitch was that you could, quote, improve your image by owning your own bank, or that you could start a bank to hide money from a, quote, vindictive ex-spouse. Of course, the so-called vindictive ex-spouse usually referred to tax collectors back in your home country, which, in the late 1990s for the clientele of Nauru, was most likely to be Russia. One estimate from the U.S. Treasury Department around this time suggested that roughly 400 of these banks were set up in this illicit bonanza.
So, you know, I'm there, and I'm very upfront about what I'm doing. I want to see where the banks are. And they all tell me, oh, yes, well, all of that is in this building down here. And sure enough, it was just a simple little, duplex structure, two doors centered in the middle of this little building. And I could see that out of every window was an air conditioning unit. Because having, obviously, that many computers in a hot equatorial climate is dangerous for computers. So this little building was just this giant refrigerator.
As Jack stood there, he contemplated what that building represented. Millions of people were poorer because of that building, because of that shack, robbed of their country's wealth by greedy oligarchs and criminals from Russia's rapidly expanding underworld. People thousands of miles away had almost certainly been murdered over the vast sums squirreled away in that shack. But Jack was there to check it out, not to ponder it.
And so I went up there and banged on the door and said I wanted to see if I could find somebody there who would give me a tour of inside this building. And this middle-aged woman with a broom answered the door and identified herself as the cleaning lady of this place. and said that probably she would be the only person I'd be able to talk to. So I did meet the cleaning lady of the emerging global economy. I never got any closer to anyone there.
The strange thing about the whole operation was that Nehru wasn't even taking that big of a cut. They mostly made money from that $25,000 bank startup fee. They weren't raking in big bucks from the billions that were digitally stored in that shack. So even as they started to face a lot of international pressure from Western governments to crack down on their offshore banks, the government of Nehru kept trying out new schemes, hoping to diversify their portfolio of offerings to people who didn't want to be traced.
Another thing they did was you could basically get a Nehru passport for $25 or something, or $50. And so, of course, that allowed for all kinds of people to create identities that were very handy if you were an international man of mystery or, say, a mad bomber. Any of those job descriptions would require a second identity. And Nehru, you could do that on the internet, too. You could just apply for a passport, send in some pictures, and all of a sudden, poof, you had a Nehru passport. No other country made it that simple.
Nehru is a perfect example of what I call the weakest link problem of international finance and governance. You can have all the international regulation you like in places like the United States, France, Japan, you name it. But there will pretty much always be a weak link, a country that's willing to skirt the rules or make their own, to cater to a super-rich clientele that wants to keep their wealth hidden. And as Jack showed, it doesn't take much. A shack with a cleaning lady is all it really took back in the late 1990s. All you need is one sovereign rogue nation, one little island down on its luck, to be able to exploit that weak link in the international chain. Before Jack left, he decided to see for himself the environmental destruction wrought by the Nehruan government, the short-sighted decision they took a few decades earlier which painted them into a corner and led to the construction of the billion-dollar shack. So he set off to explore an area called Topside, the interior of the island that was carted away to fuel economic development elsewhere.
The island from the air, if you Google it, looks like a tonsured head of a monk. There's this fringe all the way around, and then there's this bare open plate in the center of the island. When I first got into the cab to go there, I asked the guy to give me a tour of the island. He drove me around, and then rather glumly, he says at one point, "So I take it you want to also see Topside?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And of course he knew that's what I wanted to see. It's what you want to see, because it's an unspeakable horror. When we got there, what you see is blistering white, these channels and canals, because the phosphate, of course, formed in all these different little pockets and whatnot. And as they dug it all out, what was left is the hardened stone coral bones of the island, right? And it's bleached white in the hot sun. Nehru is on the equator. So there's no moisture in the air. I cannot describe the terror of being in this space. There's no growth, of course. You're on it's like white concrete. It is blisteringly hot. There's a kind of talc in the air. You're kind of breathing in this powder, which doesn't even blow in the wind. It just sort of hovers around you. At the time that I was there was no breeze. In these channels, in these coral channels, and by the way, if you go in them, you can get cut. It's incredibly dangerous to even be there. It's filled with trash and ripped up plastic bags sort of battering around in there. There's bits of garbage, and most hauntingly to me, just packs of feral dogs that sort of lived and roamed in these channels where a lot of their garbage was put. And so there was some little bits of food, you know, trapped in these channels, and these dogs just sort of roaming around madly.
The island had been paradise, but Nehru's paradise had been lost, all while trying to chase riches while riding the tides of the global economy. It was a moment, Jack says, of profound sadness.
When I got out of the cab with the cab driver, he and I stood there. He explained to me that when he was a little boy, this part of the island was forested still, and that they would come there and hunt the naughty bird, the most revered bird on the island. It's what all of them eat on festival days. It is like the American turkey would be for Thanksgiving. And they have to import all of their naughty birds now, because there's not enough of an ecosystem left on the island to support any bird life. Imagine if Japan carted away Mount Fujiyama by the truckload and just dumped it into the sea. England filled in the Thames River, or France paved over Bordeaux. Every Nauruan I met had this sort of like existential sorrow that they spoke with. You could hear it because they knew that they were the heirs to this desecration of their homeland. And it was unavoidable. It was so transparently true.
When Jack got back to New York, he landed an interview with Nauru's president at the time, a man who had fittingly left the island and set up shop on another one that also had plenty of illicit cash flowing within it, Manhattan.
I get this phone call from, I think, the PR agent for the country of Nauru. They have one. She says that I can meet Bernard Dowiyogo, the president of Nauru, in his hotel at the, you know, such and such on, you know, in Midtown for an hour. I have breakfast with him. So I was like, great. So I grab my reporter's pad and run up there.
Jack asked him, what's the next move for your country now that these get-rich-quick schemes have all fizzled out?
And he explained that some geologists had come to the island and had noted that those strange pinnacles that formed in the in-top side, the channels, created these sort of pinnacles of coral, right? And that if you cut these down with these very special saws, because this rock is the hardest rock on the planet, we could cut it flat and then polish it and make it into coffee tables. And he was saying that, you know, we're thinking that that might be our next economy. The look in his eye, you know, I said, and you think coral polished coffee tables is going to be the next big boom in Nauru? I said, I mean, is there anything else that might help y'all make money? And he just took a bite of toast, and we moved on to the next subject.
Nauru's fortunes had always risen and fallen on the tides of faraway global events. The island was the plaything of foreign colonizers in the early 20th century. The Japanese took it over during World War II, and it was bombed by Allied planes. It became a poster child for environmental destruction as it was strip-mined throughout the middle of the 20th century to facilitate growth in rich countries. And as the economy became truly global in the early 1990s, Nauru dabbled with offshore finance. But Nauru continued to be affected by major geopolitical events even later. Immigration, the rise of China, and climate change.
It is the policy and practice of the Australian government to intercept any vessel that is seeking to illegally enter Australia and safely remove it beyond our waters. If you travel by boat without a visa, you will not make Australia home.
When the money dried up from illicit finance, after Western governments forced Nauru to close down the shell banks, even the coffee tables couldn't save the island. So Nauru, as it always seems to, came up with yet another scheme. This time, it started to rake in funds as a controversial detention center for migrants and refugees who were trying to make it to Australia via boat. To deter illegal crossings, Australia's government had effectively paid Nauru to keep the problem out of sight and out of mind. The living conditions were awful, and it became a flashpoint in Australian politics. The detention centers operated from 2001 to 2008, and then again from 2012 to 2019. Nauru also got involved in the long-standing battle between Taiwan and China. Taiwan is keen to have more countries formally recognize its sovereignty, and China is desperate to block that from happening. Nauru's former president recognized Taiwan, unlocking aid in the process, and he even serenaded Taiwan's leader with a rendition of "You're My Best Friend" by Queen in recognition of their diplomatic alliance. But China dangled quite a lot of money to try to peel Nauru into Beijing's orbit instead. So yet again, Nauru became a plaything in geopolitics. And now, as perhaps its final act, Nauru, the island that's central to pretty much nothing except for the Pacific Ocean, is now taking center stage in the debate around climate change. Because as the money continues to dry up, the inhabitable part of the island, that last lingering fringe of green, is also likely to slip beneath the waves in the coming decades.
Nauru is a country that is kind of going out of business. I mean, that's what we're watching, you know, and I don't think we've ever even conceived of such a thing, that a country would turn off the lights and push in its UN chair and decommission its flag.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode or at least learned something new, please rate and review the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen. And if you're feeling really generous, tell your friends about the show, post about it on social media, or support the show by pre-ordering Corruptible, Who Gets Power and How It Changes Us, or by becoming a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/powercorrupts. It starts from as little as $3 or £3 per month to support the show, and you'll get tons of bonus content as well as the episodes early. In the next episode, part two of this opening series about offshore finance, we go to another seemingly idyllic paradise and see how businesses that seem to be legitimate and politicians that seem to be above board use the same tactics to shield their wealth as the worst of the worst criminals and cartels.
This is one common trick that was used, and nobody took care that the one person was already dead.
Don't miss it. This episode was written and narrated by me, Brian Kloss. The executive producer was George McDonough, who also did the sound editing. Music by Scott Holmes. Special thanks to Rachel DeAngelis, who helped research this episode. Goodbye for now.